This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to be able to talk to you once again. This is Henrik, and I hope you're doing well wherever you are around the world and hungry for another radio program as we continue our search for answers to many of the mysteries of our existence. For much more, go to RedIceCreations.com. Religion is mind control. Christianity has a ruthless and bloody history, and in all fairness, as has most religions and cults, and yes, this includes the cult of politics and science too, all the isms out there that are provided for you. Now, whether you believe in the existence of one who's going to save you is not really the point of argument that we're going to address today. Whether you're a proponent of the virtues of Christ is not really the point either. The point is how the imperial cult and the Roman Empire and its Judaic allies, and some would say turncoats, created the myth of Christ as a way to manipulate and control you politically and spiritually. The work surrounding the Christ conspiracy and the conspiracy of Christianity is a vital piece of the puzzle if you want to try to understand many of the problems in our world today. Asharia S., whose real name is D.M. Murdoch, was classically educated, receiving a degree in classics, Greek civilization, from Franklin and Marshall College. At Franklin and Marshall, listed in the highly selective category in guides to top colleges and universities, she studied under Dr. Robert Barnett, Dr. Joel Farber, and Dr. Anne Steiner, among others. Asharia is also a member of one of the world's most exclusive institutes for the study of ancient Greek civilization, the American School of Classic Studies at Athens, Greece. She has served as a trench master on archaeological excavations in Corinth, Greece, and Connecticut, USA, as well as a teacher's assistant on the island of Crete. She has traveled extensively around Europe, and she speaks, reads, and or writes English, Greek, French, Spanish, Italian, German, Portuguese, and a smattering of other languages to a varying degree. She has also been compelled to cross-reference the Bible in the original Hebrew and ancient Greek. She's gained expertise in several religions as well as knowledge about other esoterica and mystical subjects. She is the author of several books, including The Christ Conspiracy, Sons of God, Who Was Jesus, and Christ in Egypt. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Asharia. It's great to finally have you with us on the program. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I've heard about great things about your organization, and of course I love your point of origin, your country of origin.
Well, there you go. Thank you for that. That's great. Looking forward to this, obviously, Asharia. I always like to return to the subject of Jesus, Christ, the symbolism surrounding it, the, if you will, even political struggle. We'll see how far into it we get today, and obviously the overarching problem, if you will, of religion as well. We have so much to talk about. You have so many books out there on the subject, of course. But for potential newcomers to your work, can you give us a bit of an outline, if you will, the message that you've been trying to get across out to people over the years, Asharia?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to talk about that. Well, you know, I've always been fascinated by mythology and religion since I was a small child. And I had these kinds of epiphanies as a small child that where you were born, you would become probably a member of the dominant religion of the area. So I knew as a child that this was a choice, and I'd kind of investigated religion as much as I could at that time, you know, having other interests. Obviously, when you're a child, you want to play all the time, but there was things like Greek myths and so forth, and I noticed there were Jews and Christians in my country, the U.S., and then I noticed in like National Geographic magazine, I was exposed to them very early on, that people in other countries had other religions. And so I had this great smorgasbord of religions provided to me. And so I didn't have a fanaticism for the one I was raised in. I was raised a Protestant Congregationalist in the northeast of the United States. And my family, my mother's side, paternal family, goes back to the Winthrop fleet in 1630 that arrived in Massachusetts. So right the next migration from England out of, into the United States after 1620, after the Pilgrims. Mm-hmm. So, and they were proselytizers of Christianity. So they were answering the call from the Pilgrims to convert the heathen savages in the Americas. So no, that's what they called them.
Right.
And so I have this long, you know, history of Christianity in my family. So I had all this interest in religion, and then I went through a period, and I went to church regularly. I know Christianity very well. I attended church on every Sunday. I went to children's Sunday school and then the holidays. But at a certain age, all of my siblings emancipated themselves from Christianity. They said, we don't like church. It's boring. We don't want to go. So thanks. You know, I think I was like 12. We all decided that we would be adult enough at 12 to just eschew going to church. And so I went to these holidays now and again, Christmas and Easter, and I really like them, but I like them for the reasons of what they truly represent, which would be very poignant for people in Northern Europe, especially Yule, the winter solstice, which is really what Christmas is representative of. And so I'm not just out here to destroy it and it's all ugly and whatnot, but I am exposing the pathology and the falsehoods of religion. But having that freedom of not having been really indoctrinated into a religion. I was raised a Christian. I was involved in it. Protestantism is the Protestantism that I was involved in is very mild. It might be something like Swedish Lutheranism or something. Uh-huh. You know, but
yeah.
It's pretty. In fact, I think my grandparents were Swedish Lutherans, and then they became Baptists, and so there's been a lot of American Puritanism going on there.
Oh,
so
yeah.
it's all there. But I had discovered that this was a matter of choice, and that if we were not threatened with hellfire and all that rubbish that the priests and pastors used to brainwash people into their cult. We were the emphasis was on all the good stuff, being good to other people, doing unto others and so forth, all the good stuff. And I feel good things. That's nice. That's great. We should have ideologies that possess these wonderful wisdoms from antiquity. But that's the point too, is that they're really quite ancient. All of these stories and doctrines and wisdom sayings, they're not. We're given this impression that Christianity popped up out of nowhere as this divine revelation. There was nothing before it, you know.
Right.
And we're even told, don't look at anything before it because that's all filthy, dirty, heathen paganism and evil and whatnot.
Yep.
And so I never believed that. I was a historian going way back when, very fond of certain sciences like paleoanthropology and archaeology, and I became I actually studied archaeology in college and lived in Greece and have excavated in Greece. So I knew that the Greek culture had a great deal of respect and had contributed immensely to our culture, our civilization. And so, obviously, I was inoculated against this notion that these pre-Christian cultures were all savages and evil pagans and whatnot. And so, I started seeing, of course, threads between religions. We all hear about the golden rule and how they teach us to treat others with respect and so forth, which is not really true. There are many religions that are quite hateful towards humanity and so forth. But so I noticed that in addition to this, it was a striking fanaticism in this country that popped up in about the 80s with Reagan and so forth, with the Christian right-winger ideology. And that was completely contrary to what I had experienced, and of course in the 70s and all the discos and the sexual revolution, and then there was the whole, you know, the hippies and the drug taking and everything, and then we had this conservative clampdown, which
like
was
a
very
backlash
weird.
From this almost
very strange.
Yeah,
you know, but I didn't respond to that either, although I have to say in the mid 80s I did become a born again Christian, oddly enough. So most people don't know that little factoid about me. But that was a very uncomfortable hair shirt that I didn't wear for very long.
How did that happen? Why did you snap out of it, if I can put that term on it?
Well, how I got into it is interesting, too. You know, I went to school and graduated, had a degree in classics. I'd excavated in Europe. I'd traveled around Europe. I spoke languages in several places. So I'm quite exposed to different cultures and so forth. But I just got into a space where I wanted to learn more about the Bible. I was trying to do crossword puzzles, and there was, you know, there were answers in there that I couldn't. There were things I couldn't answer in there. So I started reading the Bible, and then I came across this woman in my building where I was living, who was a preacher. She was a model raised for Jesus. She was actually the cousin of Jimmy Swaggart. You might know was a huge American preacher who got in trouble for having extramarital affairs and going to prostitutes and whatnot.
There's so many that do. Isn't that funny? What is that all about? Who was the other one? Was it a John Hagee or no? Who was the other one who got caught recently?
Ted Haggard.
Ted Haggard. Yes, there you go.
The men, you know, so. Yes. Well, they're all phony balonies with the sexual oppression, you know, pretending to be great saints and whatnot. And then, like, come on, you can't go against human nature so blatantly, you know. But but anyway, so his cousin was a preacher, and I started attending her Bible reading classes, and then I went to a tent revival in New York City in the Bronx. And there was a Greek pastor in there, and I love Greece. I lived there. I speak the language. It just resonates. The antiquities resonate with me tremendously. And so I just, you know, in the passion of the moment, I stood up and declared myself born again.
Well, there you go. And it was short-lived then, I understand, as well.
Well, yes, from the perspective that I tried to follow the New Testament, and it really struck home that Colonel Robert Ingersoll was an American freethinker. He said if a man were to follow the Old Testament strictly, he'd be a criminal, but if he were to follow the New Testament, he'd be insane. And so, and that strictly, I mean by the letter,
right?
And so I tried that, and I thought, wow, this really does make you crazy. I was reading it over and over again, and I thought, there's just so many nutty things in here and unbelievable things, and you have to convince yourself of this and that. And it's, you know, it's just all, it was a big jumble and a mess, and it made me feel sick, frankly. And so, but after that, I continued to investigate religion quite passionately. I came across some really interesting commentators on religion who exposed me to religions from all over the world even more thoroughly in their greater doctrines and details. And then I was in Los Angeles, where there's a huge amount of it's not necessarily New Age, but there's this Bodhi Tree bookstore, which had all the gurus from all over the world. You know, I mean, everybody from India to Russia to the United States, all these gurus dating back hundreds and thousands of years. They have books by them. And so I studied and immersed myself into everything. Had all kinds of spiritual experiences, you know, had visions and so forth, just like everybody was talking about in these books. You can imagine yourself into these spaces so that you can have these experiences to understand what and relate to what other people have experienced. So I'm not coming from a hardcore skeptical background where I don't know anything about any of this stuff.
Right, right. You've explored many different facets of this. That's what you're saying, and across the religious spectrum, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely, and from, you know, Zen Buddhism to meditations and yoga, and we learned about Tantra. Even, I mean, there's all kinds of aspects of humankind's spirituality dating back thousands of years. But what I really liked the most, once I got past the kind of the new age self-help stuff that a lot of these things were geared towards, you know, you want to attain to enlightenment personally, you want to improve your relationships, this is the whole self-help thing. Beyond that, once I got kind of past that point of determining who I was and what I'm doing on planet Earth and what I wanted to do with myself and what was my mission that I had determined, then I was really fascinated by the mythological aspects of religion, because so much of it is clearly mythology. And that was evident to me, even if I tried to believe in these miraculous supernatural stories, that because I had been a student of mythology as a small child, I was fascinated by the Greek mythology, for example. And so I could recognize that, hey, if this is mythology where Zeus, you know, throws thunderbolts and transforms himself into white swans, or all these miracles and supernatural events, that's mythology, that's a realm of imagination, then you can't turn around and tell me that the same stories from another culture, those are actually reality, those are actually true. Mm. I'm inoculated against that indoctrination. I'm I'm immediately skeptical. Like, wait a minute, you're telling me the tooth fairy is not real, Santa Claus is not real, but there is this, you know, Jewish guy who's invisible and does miracles, and now that's real. not the Scandinavian Santa Claus, he's not real, but the Jewish Superman, he's real. I thought this is like cultural bigotry going on here, and supremacy. I can't buy into it. I mean, why is Thor not real, but Jesus is real? It's just...
Yeah, it's a good question. Very good question.
It all started to strike me as an imposition of cultural supremacy and bigotry, because we're saying that the supernatural stories that come out of this particular region, the Middle East, for example, Palestine, Judea, whatever, that all those happened and those people were divine and they're the greatest and the chosen and the superior and God favors them and all this. But all you over here and my ancestors, they're talking about Northern Europe, for example, you're all heathens and savages and barbarians and unsaved and ungodly and so
That's
forth.
Right.
And yeah, that doesn't fly with me. That really makes me angry. So you're not gonna disparage my ancestors. And as it turns out, what our ancestors were in touch with is actually far superior. It's less pathological. It's less involved with human depravity and dementia. It has to do with observations of our real world, our natural world. What is around us? Not necessarily our supernatural world. And it comes from intelligence and wisdom of living in that natural world, as opposed to a constant focus on some imaginary world out there somewhere with some giant white male god who's dictating our every waking moment. And so this is where I've come to this point now, where the point where I'm at now. Because it occurred to me also during this whole quest I incorporated strongly a sense of environmentalism that had been inculcated into me as a small child, and not in an unpleasant way, just as when my parents were teaching us, and this is, 40 years ago or more, don't want to date myself, but I'm pretty old now. That my parents had this natural responsibility towards not only their children and themselves and their community, but also their world, their planet, their earth, the environment. So we were recycling and we were using non-toxic soaps and all this stuff way back when. And I remember being shocked going to New York City and living there. And there was no recycling program even for newspapers in that city. And I thought, this is disgraceful. And then I got to Los Angeles, where it's sunshiny all the time, and there was almost no use of solar power there. And the same thing occurred to me, and I said, this is disgraceful. And then I saw there's also no recycling, and people were wasting paper, and I worked in a lot of offices. And I would, as I would make suggestions about this and say, look, this paper should be recycled, I would butt heads against religious fanatics. Okay.
Hmm. How do the two connect, do you think? That's interesting.
Yeah, this is what drove me into it in large part. This actually happened. I was in a law firm and I was recycling paper. I was making copies, and the paper was just shooting off. The people were coming in and throwing whole reams of paper into the garbage. And it was making me angry. And I said, you know, we need to recycle here. And I was a temp worker in these offices. And so, you know, I didn't have any clout or anything. But so this man looked at me and he said, I said, we have to love our Mother Earth or something, you know, fairly innocuous like that. And so this man looked at me and he said, I don't belong to the stinking earth. I'm part of my father in heaven, my father's heaven, you know, my heavenly father's kingdom. That's what he said, my heavenly father's kingdom. And at that moment, I said, we have a problem here. We have millions of people who think like this guy, and we think, you know, this is like, we had this Secretary of in the Interior under Ronald Reagan named James Watt, who said that, you know, we could just basically destroy the earth because Jesus is coming soon.
Right.
And so all that connected in, and I said, hey, this ain't going to fly. You know, the millions of people now who think that they can just destroy the planet. I live here too. And so I have a right not to have my planet destroyed. And
so in a sense, yeah. the sorry to interrupt here, but the physical world in that sense is evil. It's something to be resented. And even some of the ideas about that this is, who is it, Satan, who is the king of the earth, right? Isn't that one of the passages in there in one sense, that this creates a disconnect between the natural environment and the religion that many people then have fallen for, if I can put it that way?
Absolutely. It's all very peculiarly Gnostic, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Exactly. This is interesting. Yep.
The hatred of the material world, the prince of this world, as you find that phrase in the Pauline epistles. And yet they would disparage Gnosticism, wouldn't they? But this is a very Gnostic notion that this whole world is evil and despicable and under the dominion of Satan. But I also knew that this was not the perception of reality held by thousands of cultures dating back millennia. And so I had that grounding. The Native American cultures, for example, now not all of them were perfect, and there were some very savage cultures and all that, but they also had, some of them had this very strong sense of stewardship of the planet instead of destruction of it. You know, the rape of it, for example, is a term we hear. And so their spirituality is completely connected to their natural environment. And I can relate to that more than anything else, really. And I did get involved in some Native American spirituality also in Los Angeles, the left coast. I mean, that's pretty much what they do there. It's right. Like I said, a smorgasbord. And so it all intertwined, and I started looking at the attitudes toward the earth, towards our natural world, in both the Christian, through the Christian lenses, and also through the pagan eyes. And we discovered, you know, that when Christianity was imposed in Europe, all of a sudden the sacred groves are being cut down. And that was quite deliberate, because the sacred groves were a connection to the earth that the pagans had established for thousands of years, and they had quite strict laws about cutting down these groves, and they would go into them for worship, and so they would be a target. So here they are cutting down trees. It was capital punishment in paganism to cut down these groves. But Christians came and just demolished them and destroyed, you know, so it was just this massive destruction of culture that, not just culture, but also the environment. And I could see that attitude still lingering, and it needed to be changed. And so there was a multiple reasons for me to do what I was doing. And it occurred to me that as I started reading, you know, this whole thing started to become clear to me. And then I, I was in one of these bookstores, this very popular Bodhi Tree bookstore, very spiritual in Hollywood. And this book jumped off a shelf at me called Forgery in Christianity. Forgery in Christianity by Joseph Wheelis. And, you know, I'd already been exploring all these things and had... It wasn't that I was walking around doubting or anything like that, because I was trying out all different things. I didn't even have time for doubt, you know? I was just like, well, what's this one? Let me do this. Okay, let me try this. Let me think about that. I didn't invest any kind of, well, you know, Lord, buy me a Mercedes-Benz thing into this. I wasn't trying to get any kind of, you know, miraculous thing out of it. So right, I didn't right. need, I didn't really need to question or doubt it. It was just having an experience. But this book made me realize that certain things that I had thought as a child, and, you know, I'd since gone through to investigate, that my original impressions were actually probably more accurate than what I had learned from all the great gurus and sages and yogis. And that was, the original impression was, well, hey, if this is mythology, then why isn't this mythology? So Forgery in Christianity basically says there's, you know, there's no evidence that Christ is a historical figure. And if we look at the texts and the admissions by the Catholic Encyclopedia in particular, that the original texts are a big mishmash of forgery. And even if they didn't intend to be passing themselves off as historical texts, they ended up that way. And so that kind of opened up the whole world to me, and looking at these things through these eyes. And then as I put these pieces together, I wrote this this letter in like 93 or so, 1993, to a well-known newspaper article writer in Los Angeles about Christ possibly being a mythical figure. And I gave a number of comparisons to older gods and godmen, and also a possible reason for why it was created and who did it and so forth. And it was a fairly, it was actually a long letter, but it turned out to be a short kind of article, maybe 10-page article. Mm-hmm. And that started the whole ball rolling. I took that letter and I rewrote it as an article. And I posted it online. It was called The Origins of Christianity and the Quest for the Historical Jesus Christ. And from there, because it was so new, the internet, that my information got a lot of attention. There, we just had these like undernet groups. What were they called?
BBS thing. Or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, BBS, all that stuff. And yeah. So, you know, the... You could get a significant percentage of the internet at that time to take a look at your stuff.
Right, right. All nerds. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah, it's true. There were a surprising amount of skeptics online by then, but I guess that comes with the territory of nerd and science.
That's right.
But so I posted that, and that kicked up a storm enough that I had many challengers come in and try to question me at this and that. So then I had to start writing little addendums to each contention I had made in that article. And then it started blooming. I said to myself, well, I probably should write like a 50-page booklet or something. And so I sat down to write a 50-page booklet, and it turned out to be a 500-page book.
Yeah, there you go.
which is more than that. It was about 600 or 700 pages. I had to cut it back. And that ended up to be called The Christ Conspiracy.
1999 was released, right?
1999 was when it was published. I finished it in 1998. And I had written other books in between the time when I wrote the article. But I posted the article online in 1995. And so within that 3-year period, I had gotten all kinds of feedback and complaints, you know.
Which is great, right? Because that leads you to refine your work, look critically at the complaints that come in, and hence improve your work in one sense.
Absolutely. I have taken it to the nth degree, where I'm in here, I'm not digging the stuff out of the ground, but I'm going back to, I have dug some stuff under the ground. I've been on a couple of archaeological digs. I'd love to do more of that, but I've gone back to the earliest evidence everywhere I can find, in artifacts and then later in writings, in multiple languages. And this is one of the reasons why I decided that I would take on this task. I knew I would take on some kind of task in life. My mother was a local and state politician, very active in her community, very well respected, had high degree of integrity and honesty. She was also her church secretary, to my recollection, and choir director. She's extremely involved in social welfare. And so, you know, I just have this in me. I mean, you could say it was just in my blood from the beginning. And so I knew I would be doing something because I did all, hey, like I said, I was around in the 70s and 80s. I did all the partying and had lots of fun on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. You know, but then it was time to do something a little more serious. So I had some choices. I was involved in a few issues. The environment was very important to me. I was involved in environmentalism, hemp movement way back when. Got myself into some trouble by passing out hemp leaflets. Love hemp. But this one, I said, you know, nobody's really stepping into this one. There were loads of people in the hemp issue and the environmental issue. There's lots of people taking over, all these different. But this one is like there's a void. There weren't a lot of people talking about this information. They're avoiding it. They're afraid of it. And indeed, when I first put it online, I had a lot of people asking me, wasn't I afraid I was going to be killed? You know? And I mean, we've come a long way. Nobody asks me that anymore. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that I went online and did this. And so we're all a lot safer. It wasn't just me. We had, like I said, there were actually a number of skeptics and atheists in their early days, too. Mm-hmm. But it's safer for us doubters. You know, not much safer now. People were afraid that Christians would kill me back then. That's only 20 years ago, you know. So now they're afraid that, you know, the other fanatics will kill me. But we're still making it safer just by putting it out there. But anyway, so this had all kind of congealed. And like I said, I was thinking, well, you know, why should I hang out my shingle? What am I bringing to the table and whatnot? And it occurred to me, look, I have this capacity for languages going back to childhood. And I did not learn them. I was not raised bilingually or anything. I had to learn them like average school children do these days, starting at 11 years old or something like that. But it soon became clear that it was second nature to me. And so I would take this language and that language. And I'd take them well enough to read. Without living in the countries, I can't speak them fluently. It takes me a little while to get up to some speed there, but I can manage. I eventually ended up in Greece and speaking Greek pretty well, but which comes in real handy. And that was one of the reasons I said, you know, I can actually read the Old Testament, I mean, the New Testament in the original Greek. And so this puts me in a somewhat different situation from many of the critics whom I had come to see over the years, a criticism of religion.
Yeah.
And then the capacity doesn't just end with the languages I already know. I can learn them as I'm going along, using, of course, the experts. I don't ever pretend to be an expert at things like the Egyptian hieroglyphs or anything like that. I'm not even close. But as I was writing my book, Christ in Egypt, I taught myself a fair amount of hieroglyphs so that I was able to confirm what the experts were saying. And then, of course, I cited them. I cited the experts. I didn't rely on myself. But in any event, that capacity is not something everyone has. So I decided that I would take on this responsibility and take on this mission or role or whatever to bring this material that was being suppressed and hidden or had been lost from antiquity. That demonstrates a lineage of religious thinking dating back thousands of years. It's a whole tradition that is long pre-Christian. And to ignore that, you not only cut off the roots of Christianity and other religions that we see flourishing today, but you're also remaining in the dark about human traditions and human culture. Our own ancestors, what they did. Hmm. You know, we're basically saying everything that our ancestors did was crap. If that, you know,
let's throw that out and just adopt this new story, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, from a whole different culture and a different place, utterly. You know, it's really, really unbecoming, so to speak. It does not fit. And so I can understand where Europe, for example, has become very de-Christianized, because I know that they have that wisdom, that maturity, that deep antiquity to realize that they're not only being sold a bill of goods, but it's an alien or foreign bill of goods.
That's right. Yeah.
It invaded and smashed their idols to smithereens and destroyed their temple.
That is the reality of it. And I, you know, this is something that people have to realize. Hopefully, you know, Sharia, we're heading in the right direction. What I'm seeing, though, from my own point of view, being up here in the north, is that we're throwing all of the traditions, all of the mythology out the door and kind of reverting back into, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that everything that has to do with science or even atheism for that matter is a bad thing, but it's a very unspiritual approach to many of the mythological stories to life that can teach us a great deal, I feel. So that's one of the downsides, I guess. But on the same time, hopefully there can be a reemergence of a returning back to some of the old traditions, hopefully. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely agree with your assessment there. It was really well said. What I'm trying to impart is not a hatred of religion and the desire to ban all religious thought.
Sure.
Traditions. And that's something I hear all the time from skeptics. It's almost like they've hooked up with communism, you know, so let's ban religion.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't work either. We've seen that, so, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a disaster. But what I'm trying to have people do is reach down inside themselves and see that these traditions that we had thousands of years ago had a purpose. And it's only when they become carried away to their pathological extremes that they are a problem. The purpose, for example, with, let's take a very simple example of religious ideation that most assuredly dates back thousands of years particularly in the Northern Hemisphere and up in your territory especially, is the winter solstice celebrations. Mm. And Yule is the term in Scandinavia, I believe.
That's right.
And that really is where Christmas largely comes from, more so than the Mediterranean or Palestine. The winter solstice was not as big a deal. The closer you get to the equator, and then below it, of course, the winter solstice is in the June, but as you're getting close to the equator, you find the equinoxes are more important to people. And for example, in Central America, there's not such a big emphasis on the solstices, but in Peru, of course, the summer solstice, our summer solstice, which is their winter solstice, is a huge deal, and that's farther south of the equator. But in the north of the equator, Christmas, Yule, and the winter solstice celebrations were enormously important. And it makes perfect sense. It's logical. This is not some irrational belief system. This is not something unscientific that we need to throw away. The natives in these northern regions, of course, noticed that the days were getting longer. And then the farther north you go, you have no daylight for 6 months. And this is, as you know well, there's the syndrome, the seasonal affective disorder that is very well known in Sweden, to my knowledge, from a lack of sunlight. And so the mental health of the people was tied into the sun. They knew that, of course, that their spring would not come until the days lengthened. And their plants would not grow, and they also knew that as the days lengthened from the winter solstice to the vernal equinox, that animals would start to be born. And so the lengthening of the days logically meant that life was coming, was returning. Light, life, heat. Okay.
Yep.
If you've ever camped in the cold and you popped your head out in the morning when the sun was coming up and you've been lying awake freezing all night, you know, you're lost in the woods or you're in Northern Europe where it is quite freezing much of the year, the sun is a tremendous relief. And so it was considered the great savior. It was considered the healer. And people could see this physically, the healing going on for people who had skin problems, other illnesses like flus and colds and whatnot, go out into the sun, people would feel better. And so if you add up all of these characteristics, the sun hits the ground, add water to the ground and the sun hitting it, the buds come up through the earth. And so it was quite miraculous. And it is to me today, but to the ancients, just observing how nature functioned was considered to be miraculous, awesome, and yes, divine. Mm. And I have absolutely no problem with that perspective of reality. And so I think this is our healthy perspective of reality, because it not only does it serve to give us a sense of value for our world, our natural world, and awe for it, but it also helps to unify the entire world's cultures beyond these crappy divisions that have been created by religion. You know, my God is bigger and better than your God. My God man is bigger and better than your God. My prophet is bigger and better than your prophet. You know, it just never ends. This is all egotistical trash as far as I'm concerned. This is the pathological extreme.
Yep.
These are the dead branches that I'm pruning off the religious tree. This religious tree has roots that go back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And so I'm pointing at the roots, and I'm pointing at the branches, and I'm pointing at the trunk, but I'm trimming the dead ends of it that are keeping it. Yeah.
So what you're saying, in a way, obviously, here is that also incorporated into all of this that we're, you know, obviously we're going to get into here in some detail, is that there is a, you know, certain aspects of this, there is a healthy core in certain retellings of the traditions. There is a reason for the mythological stories pertained within it underneath, but then the application, if you will, the interpretation, the literal picking up on mm-hmm. you know, biblical stories, etc., has been misapplied. And hence, we ended up in a lot of trouble, basically, right now.
Very, very well said. Very well summarized. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes, this tree is still healthy, and the word reason is important here. These ancient cultures that made these observations did so out of reason. You know, there's nothing irrational or unreasonable about being relieved when the warm and bright sun strikes your face when you're in the cold dark. Mm. You know, that's completely rational. And so to make a celebration around that, that's part of human nature, to celebrate. And I like to encourage happy, joyful celebration. And so I'd like to focus on that aspect of religious fervor, if you will, or passion or whatever, and to, you know, to expose the pathological aspects of it to the sunlight, you know, to expose the state of depravity to the light of day, so that we can be done with that part of it or minimize it. I don't think we'll ever get rid of, you know, the evil that men do, so to speak, but we can minimize it by focusing on something that actually unites us. And in my work, I'm not encouraging people to turn, you know, to become like sun worshipers, or to go out and make sacrifices to the sun or anything like that. The sun obviously doesn't need us to make sacrifices to it. It'll do just fine. But just to have an appreciation for our natural world and the beauty of it. Like here's what I like to say. Mm-hmm. I think there's a time for atheistic thought, and I think there's a time for appreciation of the concept of divinity and awe. And I like to think appropriately in any given moment. So if something horrible happens to someone, like a small child or someone innocent or something, and I'll say, logically, my mind will think, well, obviously there's no good omnipotent God in charge of everything, because these horrible things happen to good people all the time. On the other hand, if I go up to a mountain, I have a couple of very favorite mountains that have just, they're amazing mountains. They have incredible views. They just blow your mind. And so you go and you stand on a mountain and you stand there and you, you know, I think you need to be free to feel or think as you wish on, in that given moment. If you feel like having a spiritual communion with the cosmos, then that's up to you. Mm, and of course, I've done that too. So I reserve the right as a free thinker to move between these two worlds where appropriate, where it feels right, where it's where it is rational and sane and reasonable.
That's right. I think that's essential. And again, this is the personal individual application. And again, then we can a little bit later here go back to the problem also of the religions themselves, that this, what you're talking about here, this freedom in many cases is something that is restricted in one sense or another. It's telling you how and in some cases even obviously what to worship and what not to worship, which encroaches on this natural connectivity that I think everybody has to our surrounding, to our environment, to the earth, and also to the other maybe unseen spiritual component, to the cosmos, whatever you want to call that, basically.
Yeah, it's absolutely the case. There have been people throughout antiquity. Let's take the sun as an example, because it's so obvious and it's been the object of adoration in numerous cultures worldwide, including even today. In India, for example, and in parts of, let's say, Russia or that part of Asia, the sun is still, Peru, still, the sun is still considered the most visible proxy for the deity, of the deity. Sun worship in India is quite abundant still, of course, you know, because it's natural, because Indian culture goes back thousands of years, and that was the thing to do. There were other, in other places, you have night sky, the night sky being more important than the day sky. For example, in the desert regions, the night sky is when they can travel and be relieved of the oppressive heat from the day. And so their focus is more on the moon and the sun, the stars, and that's why we have Judaism and Islam being very lunar oriented. They have, Judaism has some solar aspects in it as well. In fact, the main tribal Jewish god Yahweh was considered a sun god to a significant extent. But there's also this whole lunar aspect of it, because they were desert nomads at some point. And so you see this transition in history as well. You see earlier cultures, pre-agricultural cultures, as being more night sky oriented in various regions. And then as the agricultural art is more developed, you see people focusing on the sun more. So you had these settled communities that were more solar oriented. And then you had these night sky people who would hide in the hills at night and swoop down and prey on the solar settlements. So I think we can see that throughout the Old Testament, in fact.
It shows that that's connected to both geography in one sense, but also then in environment and weather once more. And we have another aspect to this component, which might lead us into astro-theological concept. And even when we're talking about navigators, sea people, seafaring merchants, etc., that they develop a relationship to the stars for purposes of navigation and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Very good. You know your stuff too. That's good. You're led right into that lovely word, astrotheology. Very nice.
A big component to all of this, of course. One thing I would like to get to here, we're going to take a little break in a little while here and then carry on in the next segment, obviously. But from my point of view, what I see two different strands, of course. We have the mythological aspect that we've kind of briefly talked a bit about, and then we have the political aspect, and maybe we can just spend a few minutes on that, because this is one of the big factors, of course, that religion, as it says on your first book, I think the blurb on the backside, it says that the religion of Christianity and Jesus Christ were created by members of various secret societies, mystery schools, and religions in order to unify the Roman Empire under one state religion. This is obviously the political angle, if you will, to this whole story. Again, there is a reason then for the creation of something like this. And these two strands is obviously merged together at one point here as well. You have a mythological component being brought out from the ancient world, overlaid by political reasons, basically. What can you say about the politics here, Asharia?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a brilliant insight. That in the Roman world, the Greek world, let's say, too, but the Roman world was even more expanded in some ways because it incorporated cultures from, all the way to India and beyond. And that's what people don't realize is when they're looking at when Christianity was beginning to be formulated, we have to look at the milieu, so to speak, of the Mediterranean, and there was quite a lot of traffic going on. It was not some isolated small thing. There were millions of people traveling around the Mediterranean, and they were going from Great Britain, which obviously was not called Great Britain then, but they're going from the British Isles all the way to India and possibly even into China. There was the Silk Road that has been around for 3,000 years at least. Mm. And so there was this huge amount of exchange, cultural exchange going on when Christianity was beginning to be formulated. And there were dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of little sects, religions, cults all over the Mediterranean and beyond. There were Indians in the Roman Empire bringing their religion there. Obviously the Egyptians, the Greeks. And so the Romans had this extensive pantheon that incorporated pretty much everyone. There were some rules. You had to recognize the head of Rome, and also the Jews were actually exempt from that because that was considered idol worshiping. But and so there was this friction going on between the pagans, who had, you know, in their polytheism they accepted pretty much everybody's gods, and if you were defeated in battle by a group that had a different god, you might adopt it, like the Romans did with Mithras. You think, hey, maybe their god's better than ours. Let's stick this one in here too. And so, it's actually quite brilliant to just have this capacity to absorb other people's ideas about the spiritual or natural world. This is what happens in Hinduism as well, which makes it a far more tolerant ideology than the rest of the ones we see dominating the world at the moment. But so they had all these different gods all over the place, and then you have the one trying to dominate and become supremacist. And under these circumstances, we had, you know, the stubborn group of chosen people, so to speak, who thought that the whole world needed to be under the dominion of the Jewish tribal god as the monotheistic sole ruler. And when the Romans destroyed the temple in 70 AD or CE, you can imagine there was some kind of concerted backlash to reimpose what they had believed, these chosen people had believed, that their ideology was destined to take over the world. It says it in the Bible. You know, you're going to dominate the world with this stuff, this monotheistic desert ideology. And so there had to be an effort to reimpose that on the on the Roman world and to dominate that. So what we see happening then is all of these gods that were in that pantheon of the Mediterranean at the time, a little bit of this is taken, a little bit of that, a little bit of this one, that one, whatever the most powerful and predominant religious notions, spiritual notions, healing ideas were around, those were glommed onto. Because if you were going to establish yourself as the dominant religious idea and as a priesthood, now this is already happening in the Old Testament. So this is not a new thing. The Old Testament priesthood is dominant. They're going around destroying the high places. The high places are the places of both worship and sacrifice, food sacrifice for the, let's say, the Canaanite peoples, or even later on, you know. But you see this all throughout the Old Testament. They want to centralize the religion. They want to impose Judaism or Yahwism on all of these peoples. They want to destroy their gods. They want to raise up Yahweh above them all. And so we find this effort throughout the Old Testament, and we find it again in the New Testament. Now, this time around, they couldn't just rely on the prophet Moses, apparently, you know, he has some supernatural stuff he did a few years ago, a few centuries ago. That's old history. We got to have a new one. And this new one has to compete with Zeus and Thor, even. I mean, all these cultures were all getting to be known by the Romans, the Brits. They have Jesus the woodworker.
Yeah, you know,
sounds a little bit familiar to Jesus the carpenter. Jesus the carpenter.
Yep.
Yeah, and all of the Roman gods, like Jupiter and Juno and the sun gods, Apollo and Helios and the Egyptian gods. And I mean, so in order to compete with those, what do you do? So obviously, in order to do this, you have to not only take all of these mythical motifs and wisdom sayings and mystery school doctrines and rituals and make them essentially to revolve around your ethnicity, which is what happened. They were Judaized. But you also have to utilize the political structure to impose it on everyone. And so we have, you know, you can see how it's being developed in the late first to early second centuries, how the effort becomes increasingly to impose central authority on humanity through this ideology. We have, you know, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and slaves obey your masters in everything, and all these authoritarian statements. Women, you know, basically shut up, don't talk in church, don't teach people, you know. They throw in all this stuff. They have Jesus mouthing, I think it was Julius Caesar's passion for monogamy and marriage. That is not necessarily Jewish in that in the New Testament. That's clearly a Roman, and it's Julian idea that one man and one woman must be married for all eternity. The real Catholic idea of marriage is Roman. And so you can see all these little bits of propaganda, if you will, of vested interest in these texts. And, you know, so unless Jesus Christ was the historical mouthpiece of the Roman Empire, this, you know, rather than some god in the sky, then, you know, this is a fictional story devised for specific purposes. One, to impose a Judaized interpretation of God and religion on everyone. Two, to impose Caesar as the temporal leader of the world. You know, Jesus is the king of the kingdom of heaven, but render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. There we go. We're splitting the material and the spiritual world again, and the material world is no good anyway, so just let Caesar have it. And, you know, that makes Caesar very happy.
Yeah, oh yeah, of course. Turn the other cheek and don't protest, basically. It's a political strategy. It's a statement, and that's obviously what we're kind of trying to get to here. And this is, there's so much more on this point that I want to, you know, ask you more about as we continue over in the next segment here. But before we do that, before we take a little break here, I want to give you opportunity to give out all your websites, of course, and mention your book titles as well. What we, the only one basically we mentioned so far is your first book, as you said, published in 1999, The Christ Conspiracy. And I think you've done, what, 8 books in total, something like that, on this, obviously on the same general topic. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've been busy since then. I actually have a significant amount of a revision written for The Christ Conspiracy, but boy, it's a real task because there's been such a massive amount of material that's come to light, and then we've had the ability to get our grubby little paws on millions of books around the world in a variety of languages through the internet. So
yeah,
since I wrote that book, the information explosion has been tremendous. So now I'm wading through this huge amount. But I also have, you know, one of the books I wrote was in response. My second book was in response to the criticisms of ChristCon, as I call it, the Sons of God, S-U-N, Sons of God, Krishna, Buddha, and Christ Unveiled. And I have included in there not only more information on some of the most controversial points in Christ Conspiracy. Some of these things I would change as far as the language goes. That's why I'm doing a revision. But I show where my contentions come from and go into the background of the history of this field, which you could call the field of mythicism or the mythicist school. So that history is really interesting too. So that's in Sons of God, and it compares Krishna, Buddha, and Christ as solar figures, and shows how they are patterned on as sun gods, basically. And then after that, I wrote a book called Who Was Jesus? Fingerprints of the Christ, where I give, it's a short book, it's to be easy to read. I was asked by a number of people to give an outline of the basics of New Testament criticism. And, of course, that would include the dating of the Gospels and contradictions between them and other insights like translations, like the King James Version. Mm-hmm. And I'm basically giving what is New Testament scholarship of the day. There's a lot of skepticism about various texts. I have that in there, too. And so that's a short book for this should be easily digested by many. And then I wrote this book, Christ in Egypt, as a response to this massively popular documentary called, or film called, Zeitgeist.
Right.
The Horus-Jesus connection, Christ in Egypt, the Horus-Jesus connection. That was really glommed onto, and people were going berserkers trying to figure out whether or not what was said in that film was accurate and where was the information. And so I really worked incredibly hard, almost I got very ill during that project, to get that book out as soon as possible. And it's almost 600 pages. I sorted through thousands of ancient Egyptian texts, often in their original form, hieroglyphs. And all of that is in there. It's a kind of a difficult book to read in that sense that it's extremely scholarly. And I don't know if I could do it again. But if you're looking if you're looking for the hardcore primary sources and scholarship from highly respected, credentialed individuals on the subject of Christianity and Egyptian religion and the comparisons that we find in the Zeitgeist film, then you have to have this book, Christ in Egypt, which is available on Kindle, too. All of my books are available on Kindle now, so you can get them all over the world. You don't have to have these expensive tree-cutting-down versions. But, and so, you know, then I also wrote The Gospel According to Acharya S., which is a kind of a short book, just a little more ranty. There's some scholarship in it, but it's essays on subjects like God and prayer and all of these things associated with religion. And then I published a book called Man-Made God. I edited it and wrote the foreword to it by Barbara Walker, and that one's fantastic. I've got a lot of images in there. She talks about these issues as well. She talks about a lot of free thought subjects. And, of course, the astrotheology calendars that I've been making for the last 3 years have some really interesting information. The first one especially, I put in holidays from around the world dating back thousands of years. I calculated them, the Egyptian holidays from ancient calendars. I calculated them to when they would have fallen in the year one, or before, you know, when Christ supposedly was born. And so that they show some really interesting patterns, like the Egyptian god Osiris dying and being reborn at the winter solstice at that time in that year. The Egyptian calendar is wandering.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. And so, in fact, if you look at the December month of that calendar, which is the 2010 calendar, it shows you just a huge amount of solar and winter solstice celebrations that date back thousands of years. And you can see where, you know, Christianity borrowed or usurped different holidays and reworked them to revolve around themselves. For example, we had the Festival of Minerva on the 4th of December, and it's been turned into the Feast of Santa Barbara in the Catholic Church. And so that happens over and over and over again.
Yep, yep.
And, you know, that includes, I mean, the winter solstice, we have the Feast of Isis in that year. We had the Festival of the Rising of Osiris, the Festival of Sokar, who was a baby falcon who was brought out of a temple and greeted by three dignitaries. He's in a manger, so to speak. This is the sun god. These are very important things. And I was able to trace these ancient Egyptian icons to some testimony in the early church fathers as well. And some of these things, and this is all in Christ in Egypt, some of these statements by the early church fathers had not been published in English. They're in Greek or Latin.
Mm-hmm.
They they appeared in foreign language publications, such as in German. And so I had to dig into all these languages, modern foreign languages as well, German, French, Italian, sometimes Spanish a little bit. I've had to work in those languages as well. And I translated some things and included a lot of research in Christ in Egypt, for example, that had not been rendered into English before.
Excellent. So dig some of these gems out, basically, to the English-speaking world, yeah?
Yeah, well, this one, for example, it was the, I think it was the writing of Epiphanius that was talking about the virgin mother in Egypt giving birth at the winter solstice and everyone shouting, and you know, it's a great joy. And this astonishing passage was actually removed from the English publication of Epiphanius's writings, and so I had to go into a German one to find it. But
when was that, by the way? When was the censoring? Do you know?
Yeah, that would be at the time of Migne, who was the French scholar who put together an enormous amount of the writings of the early church fathers. And I believe, I'm going to look this up right now. Yeah, okay. He was in the 19th century, the priest. And so in the 19th century, this was edited out. Now, whether there are earlier editions, it's a good question. But I was quite astonished because I went and dug into these Migne editions. And I'm looking around like, what the heck? I don't see this. Why does everybody cite this? And someone sent me the German edition. In fact, that was Jan Irvin. Thanks, Jan.
That's
Jan
right.
Irvin,
we've had him on the program a couple of times. Excellent.
Thanks to him, I got my hands on that
Epiphanius
edition in German. And sure enough, they had just cut it out. And now you have to ask yourself, why would they cut it out?
Indeed.
And so these are the questions that I asked all along, and I realized because it obviously in this case it was not good for the upholding the faith, you know, because it would cast doubt on whether or not the New Testament account was historical or was it based on ancient mythology.
But again, it shows that as we know through all the ecumenical councils, the Bible, etc., has gone through tremendous amounts of rewritings. So this is an ongoing process, basically. But this, the example you just made, shows that it's relatively recent in comparison. I mean, rewriting has happened, since what, year zero, right? They began writing the history. So it's been taking place ever since, basically. But again, it shows that it's ongoing. That's my point. The censorship is not done from their point of view.
Oh, yeah. Well, the censorship now is to just chase me off the stage and other people who are exposing this stuff.
We're
castigated, ridiculed, ostracized, you know, attacked viciously, personally, and so forth and so on. But, and I think that's probably what happened in, you know, the 19th century was this great blossoming of mythicist thought where people were saying, hey, look at all these pre-Christian precursors of Christianity, and maybe this wasn't a true story, and maybe it's been fabricated and so forth. And then there was this concerted effort to chase all these people away. And it worked, and it succeeded for about, you know, a few decades, and then we all started popping up again at the end of the 20th century. So I don't think you can keep this information down forever, and I kind of see Christianity going the way of the, the ancient mythological systems that we now speak unhesitatingly as myths. I mean, nobody's running around saying that the ancient Greek gods really were real people who were aliens or whatever living up on Mount Olympus in a spaceship or something. I mean, I'm sure
there's
people
there are those who say that too. So, you know, no, it's true. There is. Ancient Alien series on history, they're hugely popular. You know, they're obviously revising and looking at all of this stuff from a different angle, different point of view, which is all healthy. And at the end, I think, why not reevaluate everything, look at everything, and come up with your own answer for sure.
Well, now they need to move into the astrotheological
investigation
of it, because it ain't no way you're turning Apollo into an alien, and I'm I'm offended by the very notion, and so I have to differ with that whole clique.
Right,
but.
Right.
You know, I mean, because I see these ridiculous statements like, "Oh, Apollo flew through the sky, therefore he's an alien," No, he's a sun god, and the sun is in the sky. That's why. You know, it's really quite simple. That, I mean, Occam's razor here, folks. And that can only happen, that weird, that's called evemerism, where you want to make all of these figures into real people, whether they're human beings or aliens. You're still making them into third-dimensional figures that actually walked and talked and lived on planet Earth. And, you know, it's pronounced either evemerism, which is difficult to pronounce, or evemerism, which I've simplified it by giving it that pronunciation. But anyway, you can only cling to that viewpoint if you ignore and remove all of the nature-worshipping and astrotheological meanings behind these figures.
Right.
These
it's kind of erasing the perspective of the ancient people who were developing the stories, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I find it annoying, you know, because, right. Look, they didn't need aliens or superhuman saviors or anything like that. They were making observations using their own, you know, God-given, if you will, or nature-imbued brain power. To observe what's happening around them. I like to project myself back in time sometimes. I'm reading about places like Derinkuyu or Çatalhöyük in Turkey, amazing places, or Göbekli Tepe, that, you know, 12,000 years ago, incredible site, you know, in Turkey. And I like to project myself back into those primeval times and consider what would the human beings there of average or above intelligence be thinking? What would they be observing? What would they be concluding about their world? And our natural instincts, our logic and our reason come up with the ideas that I'm trying to uncover and bring to the public, which is a natural observation. You're observing the moon. You're observing the stars. You're drawing, making pictures in your mind, connecting the stars. You're telling stories about the sun to your children, trying to have your children, you want to pass along important scientific information to your children about the natural cycles. And so you're telling stories about the sun is born and dies and it's resurrected and it does these things and those things. And, you know, in Egypt, you're telling your children the Nile waters are the god Osiris and he's overflowing the banks every year to fertilize the banks, which are the goddess Isis, and through this fertilization we see our wheat growing and, you know, we can feed our populace. And these two divinities, and then the third divinity is their reproduction is Horus. And so you have these divinities, this trinity, for example, is extremely important to the ancient Egyptians, and it's a father, a mother, and a baby. And sound familiar? And that brings life to the Nile. Without the flooding of the Nile, there is no life for the Egyptians. And so everything is contingent upon that. All the great art, their architecture, the fact that they lasted like 3,000 years, okay?
That's right. Because they had a powerful story connected to the agricultural cycles and everything else that you need to have this vital knowledge that you need to have about the earth and its mechanisms to be able to sustain yourself and your whole culture and civilization.
That's right. So this information is not only reasonable and rational, but it's also scientific. There's no reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's look at why they were doing these things. When I was a kid, I used to think, well, the Egyptian gods are just so bizarre. I related much more to the Greek ones. So they weren't all, like, you know, crocodile-headed and weird stuff like that. And so I kind of ignored the Egyptian mythology. I was not as interested in it. But I've developed a much greater appreciation for it now that when I was a kid, they didn't teach any of the natural meanings of these things. It was all about human psychobabble. And I could only hear about how many times Zeus was representative of the male human being with all his foibles and follies. That's nice, you know. I mean, the psychobabble aspects, interpretations, the Jungian interpretations and whatnot of all these myths. That's great. You can look at that too. But after a while, it not only is it boring, but it fails to grasp the entirety of the picture. And so we move then into the natural world and their observations of the phenomena that were happening around them, including, of course, the moon cycles and so on and so forth. And so this is the information that I think unifies humanity and gives it meaning and purpose. And this is the reason why I do what I do.
Very good, very good. Then you have To Not Live Out, and The Origins of Christianity and the Quest for the Historical Jesus Christ. Is this your latest book, Asharia?
Well, that is the original essay, The Origins of Christianity.
Ah,
that's the original essay
there you go.
That
okay.
started it all.
See,
I have updated that, and what I did was, and this is what I'm going to do with the book Christ Conspiracy. Originally, I had used texts that were at hand. The internet didn't have that much stuff on it. I was around a major library, but I just didn't access it. Instead, I used books that were in bookstores and at hand and so forth. And so I used my own library to write that book. And there are some things in it that are not accurate because I relied on some other writers in some instances, but it's not that much. And in addition to that, I've been able to, since then, back up these major contentions and many of the minor ones using more acceptable scholarly sources and the primary sources. And so that's what I did with that original Origins of Christianity article. I went back and I actually added to it and made it even more solid. It's got the same theme, many of the same contentions, just using more academically acceptable sources and digging back down into the primary sources that other people had originally raised. Mm. There are, however, in my first edition, there are many primary sources used. I delve into the Bible quite a lot. I use the writings of the church fathers and other writings from antiquity in other languages.
Very good, very good. So why don't we give out, you have a number of websites out there, so people listening know where to go to both pick up copies of your books, of course, if they want to find out more and obviously learn more overall about your work. We're going to have these up on our website, redicecreations.com, as well, in case you miss one. But give us a few other websites you have out there. Quite a few, Asharia.
Yeah. My first one is truthbeknown.com, and that's been online since 98. I had an earlier edition of that, but so in 1995, I first went online. But so truthbeknown.com has a lot of my articles on this subject. And then my books are published at stellarhousepublishing.com. And there are more articles there as well that are parts of excerpts from the books. And then freethoughtnation.com is where I blog daily events and a lot of commentary on what's happening in the world, mostly revolving around religion, or sometimes an environment and other things that I like. You know, it's a blog. But I also have a forum, which is just full of good stuff, not only from me pulling up research all the time. I always get, you know, some really great research I find and post it there, but a lot of other people have contributed there. So we have thousands of pages of information on these subjects of religion and mythology dating back thousands and thousands of years.
All right, excellent. There you have it, an extended first segment, if you will, then. But we're going to continue talking more here in the next one with you. So stay with us, Asharia. We'll be back with more after this short break. We continue to talk with Ashoria S. about her work and the Christ Conspiracy after the break. Vital clues about why the Roman Empire decided to choose Yahwehism is one of the many topics that is coming up. We also talk about Serapis, sun worship, masonry, and the Egyptian, Greek, Jewish, and Roman mergers that was happening at the time around the creation of the Christ myth. This is an interesting continuation. If you go to redicecreations.com, you can read more about how to subscribe and get access to our members area with this and all of our previous programs available. No commercial interruptions and independent of network censorship. If you're already a member, click into our two or subscribe to our RSS feeds. You can also check out our iPhone app to get quick and easy access to the second hour as well. Next up on Red Eyes Radio, we have Andrew Goff, Joseph Atwill, Anthony Peak, Carl Munk, Josh Reeves, Sonia Barrett, Dean Clifford, Barbara Hand Clough, Håkan Blomqvist, Gerard Williams, Paul Levy, Laird Scranton, and Louise Turry, to name a few. Lots of interesting and important material coming up for you shortly. Thanks, guys. More now with Ashoria S. coming up.